Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can say that I get a lot of value out of them. Merck Research is different from other research, which usually just cherry picks all positive or all negative charts and then falls into the trap of confirmation bias. Merck Research provides an intellectually consistent approach by going through a consistent set of relevant data and then putting it through a consistent set of frameworks, which is then summarized in a checklist and in a concise written summary. Their monthly economic and market data review provides an excellent overview of the macro landscape. It's all compiled in one place and easy to interpret chart books with written analysis. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer and get a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com/contrarian. That's Merck spelled M-E-R-K. Or you can log on to merckresearch.com, sign up for a regular subscription, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this free offer. Now, on to today's episode. Chris Stanton of Sunrise Capital Management in San Diego, California, right? Or right near there, actually. I've been to visit your office and I forgot where it is, but I knew it was south of LA, but I forgot it was, I guess it is in San Diego.
Anyway. We're in Rancho Santa Fe now.
Yeah. So you've been on this podcast before, 2 times actually. Yeah. And most recently, a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, January 2020, which seems like a lot more than a year ago. And back then, if you'll recall, we were talking about kind of similar today, how a raging bull market and nobody really thought it would end anytime soon. And you expressed some caution. And in fact, you said specifically there would be a correction of 20%. And you didn't specifically predict the coronavirus, but you didn't mention that. But still, you said something would happen. Sure enough, something did. And there was a big correction. And since then, everything has kind of rebounded, which finds us in the present day, where we are once again facing a raging bull market. The Wall Street Bets crowd running wild, pumping stocks, GME and a bunch of other ones now. And so it's interesting. I'm very curious, and I'm sure the listeners are as well, to get your views on the markets and see where we are here as we record this on January 25th, 2021.
So let's get into it. So let's talk about what's the same and what's the different, and what's different. Because, you know, you when you look at the price action, they are very, very similar, right? If we take ourselves back to a brief history in time, we go back to that sort of August of 2019, we were experiencing a heck of a lot of volatility around the trade war, right? And we were kind of having these fits and starts. And then all of a sudden, as we came out of that summer, August, September, we kind of clicked into a raging sort of bull market, right? Where it's not in hindsight, you know, when you think about the distance we covered in 2020, we'll come to that in a minute, obviously different. But what was interesting was the price action, right? Again, very few down days. We just started ratcheting day after day after day up, right? And we started to build an incredible sort of skew into the market, or, you know, I like to think of it as a compression. We were compressing the market. We were creating a disproportionately bullish price action because, as I said back then, and I'll remind you today, if you think about the markets, they go up half the time and down half the time in the cash US session. And if they didn't, what you would have is a situation where you could design a system that in essence would do nothing more then buy every open, right? And you'd make plenty of money. You could buy every cash open. If it were the case that we even went up 51% of the time, that would be enough. Because as you know, some casino games like craps only have a 51% chance of winning. I think Baccarat's a 50 and a half or something. So the reality is, what you know is, if as soon as you have a statistical edge in what's going to happen, you could just do that. But that's not what happens. It's up and down, half and half. So when the markets started to skew, in essence, flip that coin over and over and over again, and again, someone could say, well, you know, you're sampling with replacement because it's sort of infinite trading days in theory, so long as the markets stay open. You don't need to count it that way, but you could see the compression building. However, there was a couple of big differences with what was going on then and what's going on now. All right. So first of all, back then we had normal volatility. In other words, we're going to talk about this today. The thing that should have everyone's attention and they really need to focus on is the VIX sitting again at 23. Since last February, we haven't been able to get under 21. Nate, the average vol in this market is 15. It's 15. And that's a mean reverting instrument. Why are we not going back to 15? We're going to talk about that today, because that is the thing. If you were going to look at anything in the market that should really make you concerned and give you some pause, in my mind, is that. I hate that number at 23, and I'll explain to you why. So back then, we had a more normalized volatility, right? Vol was probably sitting 15, 16. Back then, what else did we have? We had normalized rates. If you remember, the Fed was ratcheting rates, right? They were renormalizing the front end of the curve, and they had been quantitatively rate tightening, right? Rolling off the balance sheet for months and months and months. So what were we really doing back then? Well, what we were doing was we were moving to, and I don't want to be overly dramatic, back to a free market, right? Back to this free market environment where the markets were going to move, you know, become really a free market where it could go up and down and up and down. There was market manipulation was finally, and I'm talking about central bank manipulation, was finally marginalized. They were moving in the opposite direction, but the long end and the short end of the curve were being renormalized. Volatility was sitting at 15 and the market wasn't behaving correctly. You know, it was kind of doing this what's to worry thing. And so that was the setup for what happened. And I said to you back then, I said, I don't know what I said to you. What exactly said was, you never hear the bullet that kills you.
That's right.
And I told you I was worried about what was happening in China. I told you I didn't like that. And I think what I said to you was, it's all fine and dandy while those numbers are those numbers. But if all of a sudden we pick up one day, because Bloomberg was running that counter, you know, there was a thing on Bloomberg that was showing you how many people were infected and how many people had died. And I said, when that has every country listed and those numbers are material, this market's not going to be up here. Well, sure enough, that happened. Okay. So now we're way back up here, and we're way back up here. And one of your guests, I forget who, said when the Fed did what they did, and what did they do? They immediately started, they took control of the short end of the curve and the long end of the curve, right? They zeroed out rates. They quantitatively eased like crazy to flatten out the long end, and they joined the bid on corporate debt, right, which is brand new, right? And by the way, I'll point out to you, so equities and corporate debt, what's the difference? Right. They're both right. I mean, we know what the difference is. One has voting rights, one doesn't. One has a dividend, one has a fixed coupon. Like, we could go back and forth about them, but all they are is debt instruments. They're just two ways for a company to raise debt. So when they started buying the corporate debt, well, boy, you know, you had to understand that, you know, the equities was going with it. So now we have a scenario where the front of the curve's been zeroed out. The back end of the curve's been pressed to, you know, it's the lowest it's ever been, in essence, right? You have the Fed saying things like, so there's maximum market manipulation, right? Maximum. And you cannot fight that, right? You cannot fight that. So up we go, off and running we go, right? To the high side. But here's the problem. So you say, like, all right, like, everyone's asking the same question. Like, when does this end? Does it end? When does it end? How does it end, right?
Well, it's going to end. We just don't know when, right?
Right. And what I would say to you is the following. So they can manipulate. So the last time we visited this kind of behavior and it got long in the tooth, and we watched the Fed manipulate the markets post 08 and into 09 and 10 and 11 and 12, like these rounds of quantitative easing that, and the markets try to wrap their head around what was in essence happening. What did we also see? We saw one of the unintended consequences, and I'm quoting Fed Chair Powell on this, was a dampening of volatility, equity volatility, risk asset volatility, right? That was his quote. That was something that every small people far smarter than you and I concluded, right? All of the Nobel laureates, PhD, where they come, they came to school, they said, well, we don't know why, but vol's being compressed. It isn't this time, is it? Mm-hmm. This time, it is sitting at an incredibly high, in this oddly high zone. I mean, we used to sit up at 24, 25 for a day or two before immediately renormalizing. Now we have eclipsed the longest run of volatility above at least 20, 21 that we have historical data for. You can go back to 87. You can look at the credit, you know, you can look at 08. Nothing like this. I mean, vol is just telling you something is awry. So what's awry? Well, there's a couple of things, I think. Number one, there are two things that should have folks' attention. One thing you can see, so first, the first item. The first item is that it appears that the retail market has figured out how to achieve leverage. Okay, let's say that again. The retail market has figured out how to achieve leverage, right? And we can talk about Robinhood and this and that, but what do they appear to be doing? Well, what appears, everything that I can glean is that folks are running to the options market, right? Like, yeah. If you're a retail investor, how do you achieve leverage? Well, you achieve it through an options, a derivative instrument. What's the derivative instrument that's most easily available to retail customers? Options. So what are they doing? They're out there buying vol, positive vol, upside vol, but they're buying vol. So that is one thing I believe we are seeing in the VIX, right? We are seeing folks, unsophisticated folks that really have no way of valuing, right? They're just looking at strike prices, looking at options premium, and they're just paying for it. Because heck, 3 days later, it's 3 year strike and you're making good money. And by the way, you're leveraged, right? You know, how do you take a $10,000 account and trade at $100,000? You buy and sell options, right? So issue one is we've achieved vol. We've achieved leverage. The second thing that has my attention is, let's just talk a little bit about market structure. I've hammered on this before, but today we all know and understand that the market's liquidity is not provided by humans anymore. There are no more people standing in a pit saying, I'm 30 at 35 on Boeing, I'm whatever. You know, there is no more of that. It's a $5 spread, so whatever. Obviously not, that's a terrible example, but you get the idea. There are no more folks yelling at each other across a pit. What is instead happening is that the best high frequency traders in the space, some of them, right? There are two types of really high frequency folks, right? There are the folks that are out there that provide liquidity under contract to the exchanges. And they say, hey, we've built a higher frequency algorithm. It will provide a bid and offer and make a market to you. And those agreements probably say they're under obligation to provide some sort of reasonable liquidity, right? And we'll talk about what that is. And then the other type of high frequency trader is the type that comes in and just tries to buy and sell all day, right? And capture micro spreads and do it efficiently. And by the way, they're also providing liquidity. I'm not in here to say they're bad play people. They're not. They provide liquidity too. But what we know is the following. If I told you that the entire exchange went electronic around 2003 and increasingly has done so, we can look no further than the iPhone, which comes out every 11 months to understand. Remember that rule, like your technology is obsolete in 18 months? Do you think that's been lengthened or shortened?
Shortened.
Right, probably, right? I mean, probably. We've gotten better at getting better. And so what I believe is happening is those pieces of intellectual property that are at the heart of the market's liquidity are getting better. They're getting better at seeing when orders line up in a lopsided way. They're getting better at seeing when the interest is one way or the other way. They're getting better at seeing when they need to go from providing 50 contracts of liquidity on the bid and offer to 5 and how to drop that out. And so what are we seeing? Let's talk about today. Let's just look at the S&P today. What happened at exactly, 7:47 this morning? Do you know what happened at 7:47 this morning? I mean, 7:47 this morning, the futures went from 38.48 down to 37, 90, call it. Dropped 60 handles, Nate. It dropped 60 handles. It did it at 8:09, it made the low. It started the move at 7:47. It's 22 minutes, that's 60 handles. About what, 1.8% of movement, right? Something like that. Let's just call it between friends, 180 basis points. Well, what's a 24 vol? A 24 vol is probably 2.5%, give or take a standard deviation and expected outcome. So what we're seeing is maybe vol is telling you the stability of the liquidity structure.
Okay.
Okay. That is my point. And so if we're living in a world where the market has, in essence, for any given moment, 1% worth of movement of less liquidity, that's probably stated poorly, but just think about it this way. Why did we trigger circuits over and over again in February and March, right? Why was the market ripping and moving 9%? You know, those were incredible moves. That was about a degradation of liquidity structure, right?
Sure.
Yes, the volumes got high, but not disproportionately high to the price movement. What we saw was the liquidity structure was incredibly efficient in terms of degrading. What we have not seen is, I believe, that liquidity structure reconstitute itself. What I believe is, in essence, is if we were to see the vol sitting at 15, you see, volatility is a tricky thing because the way people think about it, it's usually measured in terms of close to close.
Right.
Well, today, the market didn't move very much, did it? Close to close? Wasn't it like a 10 basis point day?
It was all pre-market,
so that would, right, that would insinuate like basically a zero vol, right? I mean, like, not to be too cute, but the, you know, sort of realized vol, but we just went over that in 22 minutes. The market drops 60 handles. It doesn't feel like a zero vol market to you, does it?
Really.
So I think what we're sort of seeing here is that the market has developed the ability to line up volume, both up and down, very, very rapidly. And that is causing outsized buy orders and sell orders. I think normal buy orders and sell orders to move the market an incredible distance. Let's talk about why that's happening. Well, reason one is that the algos have gotten better about adjusting liquidity, right? And you're like, oh, everyone's a seller. Look out, this could be a problem. We need to, you know, and so the market slides and slides to find that amount of liquidity. The second thing is we are eliminating players in the market by the day, meaning hedge funds are gone. I mean, if you are looking for a hedge fund to invest in, there's like 10 firms.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest. I mean, like, there's like 10 guys that have won. They've won. They have all the money. So what's interesting is it's kind of just like, oh, I'm going to XYZ. They have 50 billion in assets. They're my hedge fund solution. The problem is there's only like 5 of those guys now. So when they adjust a portfolio, what do you think is happening? Then you have more and more money concentrating in the hands of a few. So I suspect that when any one of the top 50 players in this space moves a simple order through the market, combine that with the efficiency of the structural liquidity providers to identify that order and get out of its way, in essence, or make it sort of pay an absolute, the largest premium imaginable to move that order, you have this recipe for, you have a recipe for markets that can slide. So where I'm going with this is, and we'll come to full stop, but the reality is the things that have me most concerned are, I'm saying, okay, I get it. Fed's got everything zeroed out in terms of interest rate. Fed is just pedal to the metal on liquidity. We know what that does to risk assets. We know it super inflates them. What's different this time? The 24 vol. Okay. And then it's like 23.19 right now, but you get the idea. 23 vol is what everyone should be looking at it and saying, why is it still 23 vol? Why? I'm pulling up a historical chart as I'm talking to you. Okay. On February 20th. I mean, on February 21st, 2020, vol closed at 1708 and opened the very next day on February 24th, okay, at basically 2225. And that was the start of the super spike to 85. Since then, we have one time closed at 2403, but we made a low in the middle of the day of 2028, $20.28. That was back in August 11th. We breached 20 for the first time right here intraday of 19 and a half, but then closed at 2084 again on November 27th. And we haven't seen it since. So we've had two times where we've even traded at 20 or lower since February 20th of last year. We're rapidly coming up on 12 months above 20, 21. I'm telling you, that has me worried. You know, I wish I could, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so, I mean, one of the things is the VIX, it's only a certain type of vol, right? It's options on equities.
That's right.
Now, a lot of what's been going on here is during pre-market and stuff, which is options on futures. So that the VIX wouldn't pick that up, would it?
That's right. No, so you would see an after, so the cash would not really. The right. Cash starts trading. The cash will start developing prices, I think it's like 6:30 in the morning. You know, there's this sort of, you know, the cash market opens right there around 6 a.m. ish. That the futures do continue to trade all night, albeit with less liquidity, but they will move and give you a sense. But there's another statistic that's even more troubling. So part one is okay, Nate. So Chris, what has your attention? Part one, equity vol. I don't like that equity vol is that high. Chris, what do you think it means? I think it means that the liquidity structure is not very stable. Okay, that's my point. It doesn't feel stable to me. It feels like we hit air pockets more easily. Okay, that's part one. Here's the second problem for you to wrap your head around. Last year, this is as of November 26th, okay? So this is like, you know, we're sitting in here around November, so we're going back a couple of months now. But I want to talk to you a little bit about the total point move in the S&P last year. Last year, as of late November, rolling into December, the S&P for 2020 was up 435 points. Okay, so at that point, 435 points is, let's call it between friends, 10 or 11%, you know, 11 to 12%. Okay, now let's think about Asia, Europe, and the U.S. How many points do you think the S&P was up as of December 1st in the U.S. for the year? I just told you it's up 435 for the year at that point. How many
from
points?
From Jan 1?
As of December 1st. We're going back to December 1st. I'm making a bigger point. The S&P was up 435 points. How many of those came during the U.S. session?
Oh, probably almost all of it.
Okay. And how many do you think came during Europe?
Probably, you know, 25%.
Okay. So 25% Europe. How much in Asia?
Probably less, you know, 5 or 10.
10%. So we'll say 10% Asia, 25% Europe, and 65% in the U.S.
Sure.
Okay, the U.S. was down 50 handles for the year, cash session at that point.
All right.
I'll say this to you again. The U.S. session, open to close, cash session, was down on the year December 1st.
Really?
260 handles of gain came out of Asia. 230 handles came out of Europe. That means that all of the buying happened in Asia and Europe, and all we did was sell every open. Now think back to the price action. What were we seeing? Gap open, sell off, close to maybe flat. Gap open, sell off, close. We weren't going up, Nate. We weren't buying. We didn't drive this market. Europe and Asia drove this market.
Yeah. All right.
We didn't drive this market. So now I'm telling you, that was as of December. Now, of course, we did start to exhibit some good bullish behavior in December. I bet you if I reran these numbers, we probably managed to make money. But right now, you should be taking a giant step back and thinking to yourself, wait a second, Chris. You're telling me that we didn't do any buying in the U.S. Really? Like net, like we couldn't muster a rally. It means every time we came in and found our markets opening up huge, we effectively whacked them straight out of the gates. We went yours. We sold them and took money out. And that's why some of those statistics started to make sense. You probably read them, you know, where sort of you were seeing that Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley and the big asset managers were still telling you there was all this cash, all this U.S. cash on the sidelines because we weren't believing it. But Asia and Europe, they were pushing money in. Now that makes a lot of sense. They were like, hey, we're going to push our money into the U.S. We're going to push our money over there, right? Because their markets were looking, frankly, very dicey, right? I mean, obviously the Nikkei went up with it and the Hang Seng went, things recovered. But the sheer amount of money. Now, I'll tell you something. Let's go back to, I can rattle off a few more years for you just to drive this point home. But in 2019, as a comparison, if you looked at it, in 2019, the S&P went up 711 handles in 2019. And if you think about it, what you saw was 108 handles came out of Asia, 200 came out of Europe, and 400 handles of that gain came out of the U.S.
All right.
There we were buying. 2019, we were buying. Let's look at 2018. 2018, remember we closed down for the year.
Right.
The market was down 176 handles for the year. Okay, that's where it closed out in 2018. Well, Asia was up 213 net. They bought all year. Europe was up 12 handles. They did 12 handles where the buying was basically flat. U.S. was down 402 handles. We did all the selling. So what I'm trying to get at here is, where was the money coming from? If you look at the gain, were we waking up with the market up and then we were walking it down? Were we coming in with the markets flat to kind of unched and then ripping it up? And the truth of the matter here is issue number two for me, to put a very fine point on this, we're not buying yet. I don't like that. The U.S., at least as of Dees 1, we weren't all in on this move yet, okay? So I believe the U.S. money is late to this move still. And so now we have to wrap our heads around one of two outcomes. Are we about to start hyper-buying and cause the last leg of this to the point of your, you had a guest on that said we're going to go into this hyper-spike and then collapse, right? Yeah. Or are we the smart guys? Are we kind of sitting back? Remember, we're the most developed investors at the end of the day. I mean, Europe is good too, but we are the guy. We're not gambling, right? Like, we don't have mandates to just buy where we have to. We do in some of our pensions and things, but our investors are a little more discerning, right? We kind of tend to sit back. We have one of the most professional markets, right? In terms of the quality of person engaging that session. And the net result of it was the U.S. investor, the U.S. experts for the U.S. traders in the U.S. sessions, they weren't buying it, my friend. The way you made money in the S&P and the NASDAQ was you better have been long for the Asia and Europe session last year. You had to hold that systemic risk. And then that takes us back to our first point. I think that's part of also what's in the VIX. Because any one of your viewers is going to say, well, Chris, sure, the VIX is being skewed by people buying call options. But I think people have religion also, right? They've found religion with respect to what? Hedging their portfolios and buying some volatility for some puts, right? Some basic hedging. But think about the premium you're being charged right now. The premium you're being charged is incredible. I'm going to give you a couple of vol statistics because I think it's helpful to think about. You can think about that realized vol, the realized vol, that's implied vol, 2319. Realized vol over the same period has been 11.32. 11. Realized vol is 11. Implied vol is trading at 23. You're paying 100% premium to hedge right now.
Damn.
Okay. And as you pointed out, that's just the S&P. And so,
yeah.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so, I mean, there's a bunch of things actually here. One question I have going back to the VIX, what's the historical correlation? Because you said that during past rallies or the VIX gets compressed. And what's the correlation? I mean, it's an imperfect gauge, which may be part of the problem, but
that's right.
Do we have any idea that going back, like, I don't know, like, you know, past 10, 20 some years of when there was this much of a rally in the S&P and the VIX stayed at these levels? Like, do we have any correlation to that? I'm trying to think now because, yeah, well, like, vol sold off in the early 2010s.
Let's talk about 2017.
Yeah.
Let's talk about 2017, right? What did we see? We saw the most closes of VIX on 9. We saw more closes on VIX in 1 month. I believe it was July of 2017. I could be making that up. I'll double check. We had more closes on the 9 handle of VIX than we had ever had in the history of the instrument.
Uh-huh.
Remember, that was the time when the S&P was having 4 tick ranges, 6 tick ranges.
Right.
Volatility just disappeared. We grinded up over 2017, but nothing would seem to happen. And then in 2018, we had the clean out set. So there was a lot of thinking, a lot of discussion or prognosticating about what happened. And what we all sort of decided was a huge part of that was what? Well, they were these risk premium strategies that went out and sold volatility and collected theta. So there was another thing happening. So to your question, I bet you it was a pretty perfect correlation. The market went up. Vol went down, right? And vol spiked. It moved inversely, but it didn't spike as much because every rally was met by these huge strategies that went up there that were collecting quite a bit of money. And they were basically selling themselves as free money, right? Collect the theta decay. Collect the theta decay, right? And because in essence, what we were seeing was that front contract of the VIX would roll to settlement to the cash VIX, and you were getting punished if you were trying to hold on to vol in your portfolio more than ever. So we had this proliferation of products. Now, what did we see in the last 12 to 18 months? Well, Credit Suisse closed its huge T-VIX product, didn't it? That went away. And that was a big product, right? And the guys that, you know, there were several big players that didn't make it through the vol explosion of 2018, right? So what we're seeing is there's less selling interest. And by the way, there's less, you know, sort of retail buying interest. So some of this inflation in VIX is probably associated with that, right? There's just fewer people out there that have the sort of gumption to step up and sell that product anymore to ride short VIX trades, right? Because they're treacherous, right? These are things that are like work out wonderfully until you're filing bankruptcy papers. And so, you know, you need to be very, very careful with them. So that's probably part of it. But I can't give you a perfect explanation. But what I can tell you is, as I look at the markets, you say to me, Chris, you know, what are you sort of afraid of? What I would say is this. What I'm afraid of is the following. The central banks are setting up everyone's portfolio to need to be long. We all know that. I'm not going to stand here and tell you to go short in the face of the central banks. I'm quite sure you will lose. Right. However, what I'm afraid of is I believe that it is causing a re-explosion of sort of day traders. It is causing a re-explosion of equity weighting in people's portfolios. It is causing an explosion of what? Indexing. Let's just take that one point apart for a minute. Right? Used to be that active and passive management, there was far more active management than passive management, right? Well, I believe it was last year or the year before that passive took out active. We officially went to 51-49. There was more money in passive management than the active. Well, think about what passive management is. Passive is you take $500,000. Let's say you have $500,000 to invest. If you gave it to an active manager, what would he do? He would take that and hold a certain amount of it in cash, for sure. And they would put the cash to work in dips. That was sort of like, you know, asset management 101. Even if you went as high as 90% invested, you kept 10% in cash, waiting for a rainy day to get it into a better position. And then maybe you'd cycle up and then lift that 10% back. That is not what passive is by definition. You take your 500 grand and you click and you buy an ETF that's SBS indexed. What does that mean? What it means is, and what everyone should be a little bit scared about, is the cash, the margin of cash is gone. Which means that when sellers move to the market, as we shift that boundary, there is no more 10% of total assets under, you know, as that total number of passive money decreases, whatever percentage collectively they were holding to provide liquidity to the market is gone. It is invested. Now let's go back to my very first point, that the liquidity structure seems a little gappy, right? Seems a little exercise at the moment. It feels looser. So now you have less cash on the sidelines because everyone's like, look, you point and click and invest. You don't pay fees. Put your cash in the market. I believe it's creating skew away from cash reserves. I believe those cash reserves used to dampen volatility and sell-offs. I think that cash reserve is decreasing. Add that to a liquidity structure that is weaker than it used to be or capable of, in essence, becoming faster and looser. I think that is a problem. And so those two problems go together, right?
Yeah. But how do you reconcile that with the fact that there's cash on the sidelines in the US?
Right. Well, we know that, right? We still know that because, again, we know that basically we haven't shifted entirely to passive, right? We know there's still some active. I think, as I said, it's a function of watching that number, okay? Watch that number. As that number decreases, they put those numbers out. You can get them from Fidelity and TD Ameritrade and Schwab. You have to just pay attention to what you're seeing there. And I think as more people say, I don't need a money manager, I'm just going to index this. And by the way, I'm going to go all in on basically Tesla, Google, Apple, and Amazon. Because heck, who needs the market? I mean, who needs the market? What's the point? You know, you look at the market share of those five companies that are basically more than half the market. It's in terms of market capitalization. What's the point in owning any of the other companies? As long as that's employed as logic, it should scare people. Yeah. But here's another thing that I'm watching that should be, again, if the first one was vol / liquidity structure being weak, that's item number one. If item number two is an actual, I haven't seen the US follow through in buying, right? The numbers aren't revealing that the US is on board with this rally. As crazy as that sounds, I'm just not seeing the moves. Although I will say that I believe December, we finally started to really carry some water, and you started to see that we weren't really willing to sell every sort of rally. The third part being a decrease in marginal equity, you know, in cash in the margins. Here's another thing that should sort of start to have folks' attention. Let's talk about bond vol. All right. Bond volatility. Let's talk about sovereign bond vol. Okay. People are under the misapprehension that bonds and stocks move inversely. That is simply not true. I can empirically prove to you they move in the same direction, period. Because first of all, where are stocks? They're at the highest level ever. Where are bonds? Pretty much at the highest level ever. So like, let's just say that that's just not true. And why is that the case? Because they're both debt instruments. So we talked a little bit about that earlier too. So fine. So here's the really interesting thing, but we both know that sometimes bonds move inversely to stocks, right? And that's pretty cool. And you can also say, well, Chris, you know, sovereign debt's different than, you know, sort of
corporate. I was going to say, it depends on the debt instrument. And
yeah. Sure. Okay. So let's talk about that a little bit. Here's an interesting factoid for you. When stock vol rises, spikes, when equity vol rises, sometimes bond vol rises too. Sometimes.
Sure. Yeah.
When bond vol rises, when bond vol spikes, when sovereign debt spikes and corporate debt spikes, 100% of the time, equity vol spikes. I'll say that again. If bonds go crazy, stocks always go crazy, which obviously means down, right?
Right.
Think of the taper tantrum in 2015 as your best example of that. If bonds get slammed, stocks get slammed. That's a fact, right? You will see them spike in the same direction. Okay. So bond vol right now is at 6. That's where bond vol is sitting, like 30, you know, 10-year bond, you know, it's just sitting at 6. It's not doing anything. All right. So recently I was reading a bunch of articles that stated the following. They said that I think it was Neuberger Berman had said that what they were seeing was that some of their biggest clients, and by the way, these were some pensions. These weren't just, you know, this was institutional money, was moving out of sovereign debt and replacing that portion of their portfolio with what? Corporate debt to chase yield. Okay. So let's think about that for a second. You're taking your sovereign debt, which has a vol profile of 6, and you're replacing it with corporate debt, which has a vol profile of much higher. Okay. Cause corporate debt can move, right? We know that, or there wouldn't be a credit default swap market, would there?
Right.
Okay. So we know that stuff can move. So what you're doing is you're dramatically changing the vol profile of your portfolio when you do that. Now, we could talk about whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. You could say, Chris, not such a bad idea. It has a higher yield. And by the way, the Fed's on the bid in corporate paper last time I checked. So maybe you don't need a credit default swap anymore at all because the Fed is the credit default swap, right? And those are good arguments. And I don't necessarily have a counter to them except to say that those portfolios tend to be enormous and they tend to be like aircraft carriers. And if you move out of your sovereign debt of your portfolio and you move into longer duration corporate debt, I submit to you, you are basically holding one gigantic equity portfolio.
Right.
I'm just starting to talk flag. What should be coming into focus for you is a bubble. All right. I'm going to use the word. We are forming an incredible risk asset bubble. And one in which I think what the Fed has now done is, unlike last time, I said the big difference between this time and last time is equity vol is not dampened. They have convinced people to change their volatility profile inside their portfolios, even as vol itself, equity vol, is telling you don't do that.
Hmm.
So you start to see a setup come into place. We talked about how we started last January. I said, Nate, the setup is terrible. Nate, this setup is terrible. I'm saying it again. Here we go. We have people adjusting without, I think, thinking very hard about the volatility profile of their portfolios. We have folks not paying attention to the one glaring warning, which is like, guys, liquidity structure doesn't seem very stable to me, okay? And all the while, and folks in incredibly crowded trades, we don't need to debate what, you know, I mean, you know, I think Elon Musk is a genius. I love what Tesla is doing. Should it be a $900 stock? Have they sold a million cars? Did they break a million cars? Have they sold too many cars? I was like, $900 stock? I mean, I think they're going to be great long-term. I love the company. 900? I mean, after split. So to me, we're seeing people crowd in trades. We're seeing people ratchet up risk in massive ways. And I see them doing it in very subtle ways. And I think right now folks are getting used to this notion that you don't need to worry about 23 vol, because hell, every time the market sells off, it reverts to being a positive day. And by the way, bonds have been pretty steady. There was a bit of a sell-off. And hey, look, these days we all have some Bitcoin and that trades to a daily vol of 65. So what do we have to worry about? You know, and I kind of look at all this and I'm like, I hear echoes of several different trades in the past. I remember in 1999, people quitting their jobs to be day traders. We have that again. You know, you see a rush into companies where valuations don't matter anymore. Everyone has that wrong. You don't need to care about that stuff anymore in multiples. And, you know, to me, it's like, okay, what's going to happen when Yellen says, I'm not cute, there's no more, you know, Yellen leans on Powell, or Powell's term is over, and they put someone in the you know, as a Fed chair, because I don't believe Powell will be renominated. Do you? Does he fit does he fit the Democratic profile right now?
I mean, who fits? I mean, who knows? I mean,
he's incredibly
money,
wealthy.
They seem to like that.
He's a former partner at Carlyle, Nate.
Well, all right.
I'll ask you the question again.
Now that I know that.
Take a good look at his picture. Take a good look at his whole profile. The guy's worth, what, $50, $100 million? Do you see?
And so is Joe Biden, you know, but probably more, right?
Right. But we know that there's not enough, you know, people of color that are in pictures, right? You know, in positions of power. We have seen, you know, folks, you know, a lot of the minority population hasn't had a crack at those roles. We see that, like, women haven't had a crack at those roles, with the exception of Jaron Yellen. Like, I don't see Fed Chair Powell fitting the demographic of the progressives. That's what I don't see it. And I also believe you could make the argument that the Fed's policy affected the largest single wealth transfer in the history of the markets, period. People are getting destroyed in the COVID pandemic. And, you know, Elon Musk just took out Jeff Bezos out of the clear blue as the wealthiest guy in the world. Like, there is a huge wealth transfer being affected with the Fed's policy. You can make that argument. I don't think that jives with some of the other more progressive movements we're seeing out there that have real traction. So to me, I don't see Powell going forward. And either way, if Janet Yellen is the Fed, is the treasurer, let's just say this. She quantitatively tightened through her whole administration. She rolled off the balance sheet. Everyone's like, she's a dove. Yeah, not really on the back end.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, she didn't really raise rates very quickly, and she was waiting for inflation to come back. And so she was very dovish in the front end of the curve, but she started
Once
to move rates
it,
bit by bit,
it, yeah.
And she quantitatively rolled off the balance sheet. So, you know, if there's even a hint of a changing of the guard. I mean, so you ask, so that gets to the catalyst thing. I've now painted a picture where people have bled more risk into their portfolio, at least from the bond side. They need to probably play catch up at some very high levels. That's where I'm going to come back to you with that underperformance through the U.S. session. If people start playing catch up now, they're playing catch up in the stratosphere, okay, on the equity side. All the while vol is flashing, and there are price movements in the market that are flashing real volatility. We are, you know, the truth of volatility is somewhere between realized at 11, implied at 23. It's probably like 18, 19, right? Because that's what we traded to today in at least a flash. And so if we're in a 20 vol world, people are bulling up at the highs. They're getting out of their safer sovereign debt instruments. They're moving into corporate debt. And you have Yellen now with more of a say, and, you know, Fed Chair Powell's closer to the end of his tenure than the beginning. I start to see a setup where you could have a shock in Fed policy.
Yeah.
Changing that's... of the Fed and a shock in Fed policy. And that probably gets us going.
Yeah. And that's consistent with what David Hunter says, whom we've referenced, whom I've had on the podcast.
Oh, is that what he said?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. But anyway, so Chris Stanton, I want to take a quick break and come back and ask you some more questions about this.
Okay.
So let's first take a quick break.
I need to tell you about Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can absolutely recommend them. Their research is different. They do not cherry pick positive or negative charts, nor do they fall into the trap of confirmation bias. They have an intellectually consistent approach. They grew through a consistent set of relevant data, put them through the same consistent set of frameworks, and then summarize the whole thing in a checklist with a concise written summary. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer, which is a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com, sign up for one of the subscriptions, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this limited offer. That's merckresearch.com, M-E-R. Okay.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
All right, Chris Stanton, Sunrise Capital up in sunny San Diego. We've talked a lot about this bubble that is forming or has been forming in the U.S. and elsewhere. And they're really, people have said this for a while, but there are shades of 1999 here. People quitting their jobs to be day traders and such. And it seems every day brings a new sign of this. So the question that we're faced with now is, how long does this go? How high do we go? And what ends it? Your thoughts.
Okay. So thought one is, how high do we go? That's really hard to call because it just will keep going. You know, I mean, there's so much sort of exponential skew to the way the market is moving. It's really hard to pick a top, and we're up at all time highs, right? And so things will just continue to roll until the music stops. Will it continue to roll? I suspect it will for some period of time. These things tend to go on for longer than anyone suspects. What will end it? Okay, these are the things that have my attention as concrete things. First thing I'm worried about, the status of the Chinese trade dispute. You will remember, you will recall that injected an awful lot of volatility. That was enough to get the markets fairly exercised back in August of 2019. Those were big, big sell-offs. Those were wild days. I'll remind you that all the tariffs remain in place. There was like this phase one agreement, but we didn't take tariffs off. They're still there, you know, on both sides. The relationship with China doesn't appear to be better, right? We didn't leave it in good stead. Yeah. And it doesn't appear that President Biden, at least I haven't read anything that says that he's going to take a dovish stance with China.
Correct.
Right. He's likely to be hawkish. So first thing is, pay attention to things rolling off that trade dispute. That doesn't matter, but all of a sudden it could really matter. And if you'll remember, President Trump was saying, hey, Fed Chair Powell, bring rates to zero so that I can go to war with this guy, trade war with him, right? Remember, he was saying that very clearly, tweeting and saying, like, bring rates to zero and we'll win this trade war, right? Well, now tariffs in place, rates are zero. I don't know what President Biden's going to do, but keep your eye on that. That's issue number one. It's something folks should be worried about, you know, should be focused, shouldn't ignore, not worried about, but should be paying attention to. It didn't go away. We just stopped thinking about it. It's still out there. Okay. That's issue number one. And it could spike and bring us down. It could cause some sort of exodus, right? That's issue number one. Issue number two, let's talk about how we got here to a place where the Fed was intervening in the markets and manipulating the markets higher. What got us here? COVID-19, right?
Yeah.
COVID-19. Okay. What did we invent in the last several months?
Vaccines.
Thank you. What did we start rolling out?
Vaccines.
Yeah. Okay. So now let's talk about the fact that we vaccinate 150 million. So we're a country of 330 million people. We vaccinate 150 million people annually for the flu. There's an infrastructure in place to vaccinate. We don't need to reinvent an infrastructure. It exists already through CVS and Walgreens and everywhere else. And I know Walmart's jumping in the mix now and getting ready to go. So as the vaccine is produced, and by the way, there are more and more solutions coming into the space, right? I mean, it's not like we're just sitting on AstraZeneca, Oxford, and we're just sitting on Pfizer and Moderna. You've got the Salk group coming in, right? Like this is real. I mean, there are other players coming into the space with solutions. So if we vaccinate out and cabin, I'll say this just the same way I said when I saw this freight train crumbing at us, the freight train is now beginning to pass us and go down the tunnel. But we have all these tools in place as if it is, you know, still raging with no solution in sight. So if all of a sudden we hit a tipping point where we've vaccinated off to this world, that things start to reopen and you know, sort of rapidly ascend, what is going to be the excuse to continue to quantitative? In other words, I guess what I was arguing last January is watch out for this virus. This could come into the markets a lot faster than we all think. Now I'm saying, watch out for these vaccines. They really are the straight line out of this. And this thing could be a thing of the past faster than everyone realizes. And if they are, then the tools the Fed, the very aggressive stance the Fed has taken to quote unquote repair the economy. Because by the way, the stance they've taken is not saving small businesses.
Right.
It's just battleshipping somehow large institutions. They don't. So it's like at some point as that focus moves away, and what really needs to happen is like packages need to focus on small loans, and we just need to let restaurants and bars and hotels reoperate as normal. Like as that starts to explode, like I think the elasticity could be faster than folks realize. And again, what I'm going to be watching for there is if all of a sudden, whatever that magic tipping point is, like, hey, we have enough vaccine, folks are getting vaccinated, the number, and we start to see a different counter pop up, number of vaccinated citizens or something. Because remember something, everyone's getting this vaccine. Let's just take one bird walk on this for a second. Anyone who thinks they're not getting it, let me just, here's the news flash for you. You won't be able to walk into Disneyland without your card. You won't be able to board an airline. You won't be able to check into a Ritz-Carlton or any other hotel without it, a JW Marriott. You're not going to be able to do anything. And the reason I know that is I'm also an attorney. And some lawyer is going to be advising people inside a business like, hey, once the best practice is to make sure we have at least a vaccinated environment, they're not going to start letting those folks in. They're not. And so you're not going to be able to participate in all the fun. You're going to get forced into it. That's my point. And once we start forcing people to get vaccinated, you're going to see those numbers rip higher. And by the way, the public schools will kick into gear. And so what we're going to see is a high number of folks vaccinated. I think the infrastructure is there on the basis of the influenza vaccines. And I think we could vaccinate ourselves out of this in a hurry. And then all of a sudden, what? Fed policy starts to change. It's only going to take one wrong sentence in the Fed minutes, Nate. It's not like they need to do something. They just need to write the wrong thing, right? And say, hey, we don't need to add this much liquidity anymore. We need to focus. We need Congress to focus on packages aimed at, you know, the private sector, which really can't tap into what we're doing in the back end of the curve.
Yeah.
And so I think that again, we're talking about things that could burst the bubble on
a dime. Right. Yeah, that's a good point. But when you're talking about Fed policy, the Fed has a history of leaving rates too low for too long. And then on the other side too. But so, you know, I mean, going back to Greenspan in the early 2000s, the housing bubble and such, I mean, that probably ran, I don't know how many years longer than it should have. But so, yeah, so you're right. All they need to do is make something in the minutes, make some reference about that. And that would certainly scare the market for the short term. But for there to be any sustained selling for more than a couple sessions, you're going to need to have actual action.
That's right. You're going to have action, right? And so now we're going to find out how powerful AOC and the progressives are. Because if someone's going to end the policy, it's going to come from them. You mark my words.
But they have no power over the Fed.
That's totally incorrect. Trump proved that. I mean, no, I beg to differ. They do. They start bringing these Fed chair in front of Senate hearings, in front of congressional hearings, and hounding them and banging them over the head. And then they apply pressure. And then, you know, Biden's replacing some, you know, the chairman position. Like, what I'm saying is pay attention to that. If they start to develop a narrative, Fed Chair Powell, he's a brilliant man. I have nothing but respect for him. But he has evidenced the willingness to capitulate to political pressure. He did it once. I think there's a precedent for it, and I'm worried that you could see enough political pressure mount coming out of the left, and you could see him do something sort of reactionary, right, to kind of, you know, and even if it comes in the form of, this is a guy that used to get in front of the microphone and dump the market in December. I mean, the huge sell-off in December of 2018, the massacre in the fourth quarter was him saying, you know, something, you know, that the market didn't agree with when after raising rates again, right? I mean, it was like, you know, so to me, he's gotten better at it, admittedly, you know, and he's grown into the job. And I'm not like here to like chastise the guy. I'm just simply saying that I think rich people have gotten richer under the Fed policy, and I don't think that's in line with what the Democrats want to see. And they could start to pressure, even though it's not supposed to be politically linked, and I appreciate all that, at least a bad sentence. And let's come back to the bad sentence. The bad sentence, not that big of a deal, right? Except the market dropped on air today 60 handles.
Right.
Now it comes back to my first point, that liquidity structure. We're going to find out exactly how stable the liquidity structure is if there's a bad sentence.
Yeah.
Because if there's a bad sentence, you might just hit the circuit breakers. And if you hit the circuit breakers once, we tend to hit them a couple of times in a row, don't we?
Yeah,
so I will tell you, whatever gets the market exercised, how about this? You want the controversial sort of prediction? The next correction we see is not going to be 5%. I don't care what it starts at. I will bet you it's 15. How about that? It's not going to be 5. It's going to scare the living daylights out of you again, because this market has evidenced the ability to degrade liquidity far faster than we even thought it could when we had our arms around the structure. And that's because I think the technology has adapted and gotten better at getting out of the way of the sell-offs. I bet you that the technology got its lungs kicked in February and March, late February and March, when those moves off. Oh, those guys were providing markets, right? And they've been adapting it the last 12 months, the last, sort of 8-9 months. They've been working tirelessly on it, like we have with ours. And they've gotten better at, predicting lined up flow, in essence, directional flow. So to me, what gets it started, whatever gets it started, it's going to have a disproportionate response. That's what I suspect. And by the way, I think if bond vol goes with it, here's the nightmare. What's the nightmare? The nightmare is this. Okay, what gets it started? A bad line in the Fed minutes. The bad line in the Fed minutes catches everyone out over their skis at bonds at 170 with like the 30-year at 1.79%. That rips above 2.5%. A super spike in bond value vol rolls over to corporate vol, rolls over to equity vol, and we're in a hailstorm for 72 hours. Mm-hmm. And people are getting wiped out. And then the Fed has to come in and do something in corporate paper. And then again, you need to be smart enough to go, uh-oh, here they are again. Let's quickly turn around. Or the Fed does something on the bid and bonds itself. So yes, if there's a bad Fed minute, don't underestimate, I just feel like that's what could catch everyone sleeping. Look, we vaccinated a whole bunch of people. We think that, there's a wealth transfer issue. I don't know, they probably won't say that, but blah, blah, blah. We think that we're going to start to pare back and moderately roll off, the bond purchases. Mm-hmm. Oh boy.
It's interesting though. It's an interesting question why it hasn't become a real political issue before. Like why, and Democrats haven't seized on that, on the fact that all this money, maybe this time they will, on the fact that, money printing creates wealth inequality and stuff. And yeah, maybe that's I don't know.
It's a reality, Nate. And it's a real, sort of issue. We've in essence, if you want to look at it on the ground, what they did by forcing all these businesses to close is in essence handle that business over to like Uber Eats and Grubhub. Right? Who benefited? You can see, look at the equity markets. Amazon somehow scooped up market share as everybody stopped shopping and started ordering in toilet paper, right? I'm not going to go to my local store and fight for a roll of toilet paper. Yeah. I'll order it from Amazon. Right. And as that reality reflected itself in revenues, folks figured out, right? Like, hey, this is a real problem. Mm. I'll tell you something else that could cause it. This is a little more controversial also, but we could see, something strange develop out of like the commercial real estate market. We really need to see what starts to happen over there. There's an awful lot of money levered in that commercial real estate market. I remember the last time I was in Manhattan, and I know you're there. That landscape was just riddled with those cranes, those really big, tall cranes putting up skyscrapers. And, if you say to me like, well, Chris, they were building residential real estate, but they were building high-end residential real estate. And if we start to need to repurpose commercial real estate, how are you going to repurpose it? Well, you'll repurpose it as residential, won't you? We already saw that happen down in the financial district, right? Years ago, right? Those big buildings, they just converted them from office space to residential space. So that would increase the square footage available to a market that's already choking a bit. You can start to see things that could create mini slides.
Yeah.
And that sort of has my attention. But to put a fine point on it, as I said to you, as I'm watching this rally ruthlessly ascend, I can tell you this. The things I watch every day is I hate the fact that, I'm looking out at March vol sitting at 27, April vol, May vol, 27.5. 27.5 is just that's a lob wedge below 30. 30 vol is, that's 3% a day. That's 3% a day. That's rocking and rolling. And that's an awful lot of vol priced in out there. And, I'm looking at things just eye bleeding levels for stocks, just eye bleeding levels. I'm looking at a market that was a U.S. market anyway, that was likely underinvested, as crazy as it sounds, for this move. And I'm thinking about a market that's, we finally taught our retail guys, hey, here's how you achieve leverage. Go to the options market, go crazy, knock yourself out. So to me, there's a lot of wealth in levered chips that have kind of been pushed into that by unsophisticated folks. There's sophisticated folks sitting over here. And then you have a leaking of higher, you have a debt book that's changed its composition from something that has historically a much lower vol than the instrument you replaced it with. I mean, you talk about, okay, there's your recipe. There you go. Later when we do the deconstruction, we'll go, well, you know, you threw a little pepper in, you threw a little cayenne pepper in, and then you threw chili pepper in on top of it, and you wonder why the chili got ruined. Yeah. I mean, you know, you can see the setup here.
Yeah, good point. But in the interim, probably we will, one would think, go a little higher. But then as I say that, then watch me jinx it. And then all this
I think the bull equity market is going to probably run until March. Something tells me that, and it's like never, history doesn't repeat itself, but it tends to rhyme. Here's what I'm thinking. If we get through all of February and start to trade, I'll tell you this. If you're looking at March 15 and you look up at the VIX and it's still the first number is a 2 anything, it's not 18 or 17 or at least 19 or something. We're not like down in the teens. If we haven't like, and we're still 20 anything, boy, just know that I'm going to be a cat on a hot tin roof. I'll be telling anyone, you know, I will never tell anyone what to do with their book. You do what you want with your book, but we will be trading the short side then, my friend. I will guarantee you that. Mm. At that point, I will be trading the damn short side for sure. Because if we push out through the first quarter and vol is still flashing, look out. I would start, because that's right about the time where Biden's whole cabinet's going to be committed, and it's going to be time for them to address this China issue. They can kick the can down the road for a while, but at some point you're going to have to deal with this. And I don't know. I like China to come back, you know, as an issue again, because it's to me, it's glaringly obvious and everyone's ignoring it. You know, it's like, oh, that was like, well, China trade war. What do you thought? That's over.
But it's not an easy issue because there's a lot. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot there, right? I mean, you got Taiwan, you got, you know, and some people say, you know, China needs us worse than we would need them, right? And I think we've talked about this before, in fact, you know, that they, so, right. But I don't know.
Yeah. It's not an easy call, but, you know, it's certainly one that's, you know, and I'll tell you, I'd be remiss to leave this one out. Currency crises have been the starting point of some historic market meltdowns.
Right.
Let's not forget that. Yeah. And, you know, so you can look back at like the Greek debt crises and things like that. But many times we have seen, you know, particularly in the 80s and 90s and things, there was a time when, you know, when currencies get rocking and rolling, you absolutely need to pay attention to them. I'm looking up at the euro sitting at 121, sterling's at 136. Let's not forget, we're now Brexiting. That's happening.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going on there, but here's the thing. I ask myself once in a while, okay, whenever somebody asks me what I think about Bitcoin, here's my thought with Bitcoin. If Bitcoin's worth a million, the US dollar is worthless. You understand that, right? If Bitcoin goes to a million, particularly because it's priced in dollars, it effectively means the dollar is worthless. It will mean there's a currency crisis, I believe. That's what I believe. Because basically, in order for Bitcoin to just continue to roar vis-a-vis every other currency, it effectively means that it's winning as like the staple currency. And folks have, in other words, we know we're driving our deficits to the moon, right? Remember when we used to actually play the charade, this balance the budget thing and focus on the budget gap? Remember that, deficit?
Yeah.
Right? Remember that? Remember when the debt went over a trillion? Remember when the national debt crested a trillion and it was like a big deal? Now we're just printing, you know, trillions and throwing it. That we don't have it. I mean, the taxes we collect in this country don't come near covering any of these aid packages. So what we're doing is just obviously printing money, right? We're just buying our own debt and printing money. Okay, fine. What's the day the market goes, you know what? You can't hold dollars. They just print them off a press and they're not worth anything. And I don't want to hold them. Collectively, you know, sort of the world makes that call. I don't know when that happens and how it reflects itself, But one thing we ought to pay attention to is we're quantitative easing ad infinitum, by the way, just ad infinitum quantitative easing, is keep one eye on the currency market. It's particularly as the 30-year maybe gets under 1%, you might want to take a look at, like, I don't know, carry trades and think about whether anyone's going to want to hold US dollars in a bank account.
Right. Well, I hear that argument, but I mean, remember that, okay, so if everything leaves a dollar, like, where are they going to go? They're going to have to go somewhere else. And these are all fiat currencies, and all this, the major central banks are doing the same thing, right? I mean, okay. But, so then maybe then they argue, and this is the crypto argument, is that everything goes to cryptos. But what is that backed by? An algorithm? You know, I mean, that's just, I'm not sure that holds much water. I mean, what do I know?
I'm with you. Listen, I mean, with respect to cryptos, I've long said, you know, I mean, I have good, you know, people I respect very much, you know, on the other side of that trade, they love it as a crypto, yeah. You know, you got, you know, crypto, and they're smart folks. I just sort of say, what are you going to do when the US government says you can't use it anymore? I mean, what's it going to be worth? I mean, the whole problem with crypto is it's really hard to tax those transactions.
Right.
You know, and once we, but what also China is creating a digital currency. Why? They're all about control. What they figured out was that this tool that was supposed to be created to liberate the world is going to create more control. They're going to be able to tax at point of transaction, every single transaction in their country. The US is going to go, that's genius. We're doing the same thing. We create a digital currency, right? Now there's no more cash. They can tax you at point of transaction. The whole thing gets turned, right? This invention that was supposed to liberate becomes a weapon. It always works that way, Nate. Yeah. And then what do we have? We have a situation where crypto is worthless, because in order for the US crypto to be, they say, oh, and by the way, Bitcoin's outlawed. There you go. Now you go from being a billionaire to whatever overnight, zero, that's gone, it's garbage. And the other ones take over and then they force everyone into it. So it's like, hey, thanks crypto guys for inventing a way to no longer have any cash in your world, right? Thanks a lot for that.
Right.
And but I mean, isn't that the more likely story here?
That's what I think.
I mean, then, or are we like, no, we're going to Cowboys and Indians. It's going to be amazing. You know, it's like, we're going to be able to, it's going to be the Wild West. We're going to be able to like have this currency that governments can't track. And we're going to like, it's like, are you crazy? Yeah, right. The entire tax system doesn't work like that. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. Now, of course, they're going to regulate the heck out of it. And they're going to look to replace it. China's already doing it.
Right.
If China's moving into this space, it's about control. It's not about liberating.
No doubt.
They're not huge advocates for freedom, all right?
No.
I mean, it's
yeah.
not their thing. So, you know, this notion that it's like, woo, it's going to save us and, you know, we're going to beat the man. We're not beating the man with it. We're just giving them a roadmap to controlling every transaction. So, yeah, I hate it. I think it's, you know, I look at it and I'm like, I'm happy it exists because it moves around a lot. I guess it's fun to trade, but... You know, to me, it's, you know, I kind of, but anyway, I digress. What I would say is, I guess my final indicator will be look at currencies, just keep one eye on it. If something really weird starts to happen there, and you'll know it, but big things have small beginnings. Sometimes they can just start behaving and strangely. I mean, remember something, we are at all time highs in the equity markets.
Yep.
We are at all time lows in US interest rates, all time, right? Like we've never, ever, ever been lower in rates. And we've never, ever, ever been higher in equities. And vol has never, ever, ever stayed this high this long. And so if one more thing happens that's weird, like currencies have never, ever moved it, like, you know, like dollar yen has never traded there. Or if you hear one more never, like, don't ignore it, okay? Like, some of these things can hit you in the face like a Mack truck. Like, let's not all sit around like, isn't that strange? Look at that.
You
know, dollar Swiss just collapsed. The Swiss franc's worth a gazillion dollars. Isn't that really? That's weird. Yes, they printed money to keep the value of their currency down. And what'd they do? They bought Apple with it. They are the largest holder of Apple, of probably, any hedge fund, of anything. There's been articles written about this. These guys... printed Swiss francs, transferred them to dollars to keep dollar Swiss down, like literally bought dollar Swiss, keep the Swiss franc down, and then turned around and were like, what do I do with all these dollars? You know what? Let's just buy Apple. I mean, like, if you would have told me that a decade and a half ago, I'd be like, that's outrageous. How is that even lawful? Why would we want the Swiss National Bank to be the largest shareholder of like a US company? It's crazy. So yes.
Oh, better them than the Chinese, but yeah.
Agreed. I understand that. So anyway, you get my point. They have huge vol in their portfolio, you know, huge, right? Because they have single stock risk here, right? And they're holding like a basket of these guys. And so that's incredible. Like, I think it's just when you start to wrap your head around risk out there, you know, it's kind of like you ask the question, hey, Chris, what could go wrong? I don't know, Nate.
Yeah.
Anything in Switzerland would be scary for starters. some change in policy over there that no one sees coming? Like, hey, we're not allowed to own more than 2% of any equity, or it's not allowed to be more than this percent. They pass that law, and the next morning, Apple will be down, you know, will literally be in half, right? Because the market will punish them on the exit out. And if that happens, since Apple's like, what, a quarter of the market's market cap or something, you know, you're looking at an epic, you know, you're looking at circuit breakers tripping for 3 days in a row while they adjust. It's kind of like, again, it comes back to my point, you never hear the bullet that kills you.
Yeah,
like,
that's a good point, actually. Are they really, are they the largest holder of Apple?
I believe, I read a Bloomberg article. I'm not making that up. I promise you, if they're not the largest, they're one, they're the top five largest shareholder of it. The amount they own is bananas, truly bananas. Because I remember the issue resurfacing during the massive sell-off in March. Folks, because Apple went down like, what, a third? You know, everything lost like a third. And I remember thinking, you know, my goodness, you know, what is happening over at the SMB today? Somebody is just, you know, in the fetal position under their desk. With that position on, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you know, it's like, Francisco, we have a problem, you know? You know, like, how many are we long? You know, like, most of them, you know, I mean, like, you know,
all of them,
all of them, I think. You know? You know, I think there are some things out there. Having said all that, you know, minus the theatrics, I stand humbled once again before the Fed's market power. You know, I know you are one of the few people that know I called the top and I called the low. I told you that day, I called the low that day on Twitter. I said, this is it, folks, load up right here. It's over. You know, that was the dump. You could see it in the volume and all kinds of metrics. And the Fed had announced, man, we are on the bid in corporate debt. And I was like, if you're not, you know, but all the while, whoever, you know, who got the message first, to my point earlier, it was Asia and Europe. They ripped it. And if you remember, every day we would come in and wet, just crush it on the open. The volatility was incredible, but then it would come back by the end of the day. And it was sort of, there were lots of days where we would open up. Even the day after Biden was elected, that was a great example. Remember that day? The markets opened up almost 3% and closed up 1%. It was actually one of the biggest down days we'd had in a while. Cash open to cash close, we were down 2.25% that day. That was a 24 vol down day, masked within a 1.5% up day. So what I'm saying is there's a lot of dicey price action in this market being masked in this move. So as we all sort of sit back and congratulate ourselves and high five for the markets, you know, just tracking towards these never ending highs, I would warn you that the price action is quite a bit weaker than that on a day-to-day basis. It has these air pockets and, you know, there's still a kind of willingness to take profit, you know, when we see these gap opens, you know, in the upwards to the upside. So,
interesting points. Chris Stanton, Sunrise Capital Management out in sunny San Diego. Thank you so much for rejoining the Contrarian Investor podcast. That's a good way to wrap up. We know your Twitter handle and the website. I will put those into the show notes so you can all follow Chris there. And thank you all for listening and watching. And we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.